that's when we last met. And so we will have two sets of minutes to review today. The last meeting was a joint meeting with the commission, and so we need to approve the minutes of April 16th that relate to the advisory committee meeting, and also the minutes relating to the advisory committee, the commission meeting, joint meeting. So if someone would like to make a motion for approval of either of those sets of minutes or both, let's think of both. Any reason why we should not approve those minutes? Anybody have any corrections or additions? Let's assume then that they meet the approval of everyone, and we will go forward. In the interest of time, we do have a full agenda, and much of what we will talk about today centers back on reviewing what has transpired in the past and to give an update of where we're going. But we have Max Backlund. Max, tell us a little bit about Max and what you're up to. You can prevaricate a little bit if you'd like. You can tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Do you want me to start my
PowerPoint? Well, tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll hear you have your presentation. We want to know a little bit about Max.
So I am the director of Utah Community Builders at the Summit Chamber. I've been there for about a year. Before that, I worked for the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, and I was the head of a department there called Community Strategy. I'm a recovering attorney, so don't hold that against me. And I spent equal amount of time at BYU in Utah, but I was telling a professor Gibbs here that when I got into the U for grad school, I bought some Utah shirts, and my mom went into my washing machine and threw them out. So there's a real rivalry there.
Can I talk to your mother a little bit?
So,
a little conversation with her.
Really, you know, we run deep into Utah and really invested in the community here and have to be part of addressing some of these critical issues, and thank you all for the work that you do.
Okay, thank you, Max. But now tell us about the position of the chamber. I don't know if we're all familiar with what the chamber is doing.
Right. This is a new 501c3 that's housed at the chamber, and it's been here for about a year. And the purpose of this is really to find ways for employers to engage on critical issues using employment policy or practices. So we focus on about four areas. We have social mobility as one area. We have behavioral health in the workplace as another. We engage on child care and parental leave on one, and then immigration is our fourth issue. So the goal is really to help the employers understand things that they can do through their processes that will affect these issues and improve our community.
Thank you for that little update. Questions of Max before you go to the presentation? Let's go forward then.
We apologize in advance. Hopefully people can see the slides.
Oh, this is great.
Okay.
So that was the intro to the community, our organization. Like I said, we've been here for about a year. We're a new initiative. We've been spending this past year putting our guiding policies in place and putting our board in place. Our two co-chairs are Clark Ivory from Ivory Homes and Lisa Eccles from the Eccles Foundation. This is Clark's idea. He came to the chamber and presented this idea. He wanted to be a part of this. And Lisa is, of course, the expert on running foundations in Utah. So we've been putting this board together. We have Derek Miller, who's the president of the chamber, of course. We have Sister Dalton from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as the representative. Greg Miller from the Larry H. Miller Group is on our board. We have Bishop Solis from the Catholic Diocese. David Smith from Cotopaxi. If you know the story of Cotopaxi, their entire corporate structure is based on giving a portion of their revenue to address poverty. He's a really interesting CEO, really great mind. He's someone that's going to make a lot of difference in this community. And then Crystal Magalette is the president and CEO of Flying J Management, FJ Management. She's done a lot of things with her employees. We're taking a lot of her practices and trying to scale some of those to other employers. She's a great example of an employer who's invested in the community and doing things for her employees. You can't really see Dr. Chetty over here. He's a Harvard economist. We've been looking at some of his research. So he did a big opportunity index. He's got 115 different characteristics that he looks at. He identifies Salt Lake as one of the most upwardly mobile markets in the United States. You can see that he's highlighted that here in this map at 10.8%. He's got a lot of interesting data that we're looking at that's tied to geography. I'm also a city planner by training, so I like data that's tied to geography and specific neighborhoods. And the claim is that they can look at a specific neighborhood and tell you what your projected outcome is. So there's some things that we're looking at there in terms of how do we identify areas where we can push as a business community on some of these things, and how can we help employers understand the issue of poverty. And that's one of the first things that we've been trying to do is how do we define poverty in a way that is applicable to the business community and it helps with some of those things that we can talk about. We're looking at social determinants of health because, like I mentioned, the four areas, we've got mental health in the workplace is one, we've got social mobility is the other. Those are really closely tied together. We'll look at a few of the behavioral health statistics that are tied into this, but these really tie into other chamber initiatives as well, so this goes to how the foundation fits with the rest of the Salt Lake Chamber's policy team. We're addressing housing things, we're addressing transportation, income, education, and some of these other areas that you can't really see very well, but the chamber and this foundation will work really closely on some of these things, and the chamber will take some policy positions and move the ball up to the legislature for the things that the foundation identifies. This is one of the things that we've been looking at, mental health in the workplace. This is a new report that's just come out from a nonprofit called Mindshare Partners. So they actually partnered with Qualtrics, and there's the head of global initiatives down at Qualtrics was a co-author of this report. And they've been looking at different things, and how it's really interesting because the processes are really similar to poverty. So they've been looking at how you identify and define mental health in the workplace. What are the types of things? And they take a really broad definition in this report. And we can see some of that here in that if you look at some of the government agencies, what they use is a diagnosable disorder. So one in five people in the United States have a diagnosable disorder. But with their definition for Mindshare Partners, it's about three in five show symptoms that don't quite cross that threshold, but they have symptoms that affect their work. So 60% of people are having symptoms, and that really affects their ability to be employed, it affects their ability to get promoted, and that's what we're thinking about in terms of social mobility and how do we help employers.
How do we define a symptom? What would be an example?
So they went through and looked at symptoms. I'll actually give you this slide right here.
Go ahead.
So difficulty concentrating is one of those that was the most reported. They had avoiding social activities that were tied to work, so people did not want to engage or they didn't want to expend that energy to go to a social activity. Difficulty thinking, reasoning, or deciding. These are really key employment things. Taking longer to do tasks, being less responsive to email. These are all things that are a pretty broad definition. I mean, these don't necessarily have to be a diagnosable disorder, but I think every one of us has gone through at least one of these at some point. And 61% said that this affected their productivity at work. This is a really interesting slide that talks about some of the results. So 39% felt like they had a supervisor or a manager who was equipped to talk about personal issues, which I thought was really interesting. 37% felt that their leaders were supportive of their mental health, and 60% had taken a mental health day. This really affects people's ability to be employed and gainfully employed. And if you're talking to someone on, you know, our board, they can tell you about some of these things that have gone on with their employees. And Crystal Magal is really a good example of some things that she's done in-house to try and provide some economic stability for her employees. And if you look at stress or stress management or any kind of technique like that, finances is really one of those key areas that stresses people. And so they've done some financial training with their employees. Anytime that they get a raise or a bonus or a promotion, they have to go through a financial training model that actually tells them about time value of money and how do you save for a house and how do these different financial and budgeting type of things work. And they said that that's actually helped with some of this, that their employees are more productive, they're more stable, they're on time, and that helps them, you know, on that career trajectory and continue to grow in their capacity. These are some of the commonly identified barriers that C-level or executive directors have reported. So lack of knowledge or understanding of workplace mental health, that can go to poverty as well. I mean, we're talking about if someone has a tough day or they have a child care need that comes up or they break their leg or their car breaks down, these are people that lose their jobs over those kinds of things. And helping employers understand those issues and saying you can make small adjustments or have some flexibility in your schedule or have some mental health days available can really help people in those tight situations that for just a lack of resources or a lack of community or other things like that, they can keep their job and keep moving up. These are some of the commonly identified barriers that people have to seeking help. So stigma is one of those things. There's another statistic in there that 61% of people are willing to help another employee, but only 33% of people are willing to ask for help. So we're much more willing to lend support than we are to ask for it. And I think that goes to poverty issues or personal issues as well in the workplace. And what we're really talking about here is a sense of community. What we're talking about is going to work and being able to bring some of those things to the table and talk about your mental health or talk about your situation if it's a financial problem or whatever it may be. And do we have that trust built into those relationships at work to allow for some of those discussions that could solve or prevent a lot of these problems that we're talking about with different people in different situations? Some of the other ones, insufficient health insurance or access to services. We're working with employers on that topic to understand what their healthcare options are. Not knowing where to go for help or problems with transportation. These are all community problems. These are all issues of not being connected to other people and having someone that you can call on in that moment of need to help you get through that. And the employment situation is a really interesting social fabric for us and looking at ways we can do that. This comes from a Gardner policy report that just came out on the Utah's mental health system. So this really goes back to that social determinants of health. There are a number of factors. These are all really complicated issues. Talking about this and going through the process of selecting these issues, you know, it's a little bit overwhelming for a staff of one person to take on some of the most challenging issues that our community has. But with this board in place and some of the partnerships that we've been building with Tracy and others, it's been really helpful to address some of these issues. And what we're really trying to do is bring these employers to the table and be part of this discussion and understand the issues and find ways to contribute and to use that social fabric of the workplace to address some of these issues. So we'll be tied in with the chamber, so keep an eye on some of the things that the chamber's doing. And we'll be building a partnership there and looking to move that forward. So I talked really fast. I don't have the most pleasant voice. Do you have any questions that I can answer?
Questions for Max relative to what's transpiring, an exciting kind of a opportunity for partnering in ways that can benefit the community. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
We're thrilled in Salt Lake County to have Max part of our Intergenerational Poverty Task Force representing the chamber and this group, and it's great to see kind of that public-private partnership exist there. So it's
exciting to have them on board. Well, I suspect he'd be a great addition to any board.
Yep.
Any questions? Are we going to let the visiting staff, please?
I'm curious, did any of the scope of the study include new Americans, immigrants, refugee population?
It had a pretty broad scope. I can go back and look specifically at that. They broke it down by age, gender, and race. So I don't know if they actually had a separate category for immigration, but I can look at that, or new Americans. But I can look at that. That's a really interesting question.
I mean, part of it, I'm just curious that it may even go beyond this scope, because when one of the factors had to do with concern about health insurance, anecdotally I'm picking up across the spectrum, whether it's children's health insurance or the aid that people are seeking, even the threat of public charge is reducing. Is causing anxiety for people.
Very much so.
So that's just another factor I'm curious about.
And Utah's really unique that way in that 61% of people get their insurance through their employer, and we lead the nation in that. So it's a really important topic for the employment community to understand that. We're working with the Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health and the Department of Health to put out a best practices guide. What we're going to be doing over the next year is going around to different employers and working with them to adapt that. So if you're talking about the number one industry is construction. So construction is the most at-risk industry for suicide. And one of the number five industry is the law field, is the legal office. Very different practices. What does mental health in the workplace look like on a construction site versus a legal office? So part of what I'll be doing over the next year is going around to different industries, working with them to adapt some of those best practices. And at the end of that, we're going to put out a white paper that talks about things that we've learned talking with employers and employees, and really trying to understand this issue and how these things all relate to one another. And you would be surprised at how many people will miss work or something for one of these issues. And we're trying to narrow that down and help employers provide some more flexibility there. So it's going to be an exciting year. I'm going to be a lot more haggard looking at the end of that year because I'll be doing so much running around and talking about this. But it's an important issue, and we're excited to be part of this solution.
Yes, well, back then.
My name is Derek. I'm with the Utah Private Child Care Association. So I just want to make sure that I understand where you're working, what area. Are you, even though you're, quote, if I understand, are you a partnership with Salt Lake Chamber or under?
We're an affiliate, so I'm a subsidiary, technically.
Okay. So then are you covering the whole state with that title versus, you know, as an affiliate with Salt Lake Chamber, they're basically focusing Salt Lake, maybe the Wasatch Front, but are you expanding or are your priority here to start and then branch out?
The priority here is to start here and then branch out. I also run the Chamber's Rural Initiative.
Okay.
The Chamber is statewide by mission and Salt Lake by name. That's kind of the tagline. So I'm going to be in rural Utah anyway, so I'm going to be expanding this as I go through that process.
Carolyn, and then...
Thank you. Carolyn Reynolds from Intermountain Healthcare. I'm here for Dr. Davis, who had a conflict today. But I would be very curious, do you have a sense of the number of companies that have employee assistance programs that they would be able to get their employees into to help?
So the majority of those, that 61% number, the majority of those will have an EAP. They're a little bit clunky about how they make it available, and that's one of the initiatives we have is being upfront about that. That's one of the issues you saw is not knowing where to go or who to talk to. So how do we advertise that and make it more available? At the Chamber, we had protesters come in a few months ago, and that was a traumatic experience for some of our staff. And that was the first time I heard about the Chamber's EAP. So you can't wait for those crisis moments to announce that. So we're working with them to be more upfront. And there's even posters you can post in the kitchen that say, here's the EAP number, you call this number, and this is who you'll talk to. Things like that are really simple changes that an employer can do to improve mental health in the workplace.
Patty Norman, Deputy Superintendent of the Utah State Board of Education.
Thanks for coming, Patty.
Welcome. I'm here on behalf of SID. So in looking at that slide that was just up there, and you had those indicators that were that would aggregate together to be able to have some sort of a effect on mental health and helping our IGP population. When you're looking at that, is there a plan as to, you have the primary and secondary factors that impact? Is there a rollout plan? Is there like a staff member assigned to each one? What does that look like and who are you interacting with?
So our policy team is in charge of most of those. There's some of them that we don't necessarily see. That's just kind of the generalized social determinants of health as a separate concept. But we've adopted some of that. So J.C. Skinner is our new VP of Public Policy. So she oversees that process, and we've actually lost our staff members from the policy team, so we're in the process of restructuring that right now. But education and workforce development is a big issue for us. And I worked with Tiffany Stanley quite a bit on that issue, and so I'll be taking on some of those education things just as they tie in. And it's been a really important thing for us to understand how those all relate. But that's sort of the structure is we're looking at that right now, and it's going to be part of the new restructuring process.
So adding on to that, I didn't see something along there about child care or children in any way whatsoever. I saw education, but I didn't see anything about children or family. A little context up there about community or family support,
right.
But I didn't see anything about dependents or children or worries. Is that a part of the conversation at all?
It is, and it's one of the issues that I take on as it relates to this. So we've done a working group on that. We're working with the Utah Child Care Coalition on some of those things. And mostly it's informational for us at this stage. So we have primary issues and secondary. That's one of our secondary issues. And we're learning as we talk about it how big of an issue it really is. And, you know, my wife and I have two kids in child care, and we're trying to help people understand how expensive that is. It's more expensive than a college tuition for us. So that's a huge issue that's coming up, and it really does affect all of this. I mean, that's one of the examples I use is if someone has a child care issue, you don't want to lose their job because of that. So it's an important thing, and early child education obviously fits in something we would support.
Max, thank you. We appreciate you coming in and getting better acquainted with what's going on there. Thank you very, very much. We'll go to item three now, the Resilient Utah update. Sometime we've had Resilient Utah proceeding along, and Doug's absence today. Tracy will provide us an update for the, on the Center for Trauma-Informed Care and Practice that was discussed at the last, I guess it was the commission meeting, last commission meeting, where the chairman indicated that we would be interested in looking for an opportunity to be a part of or to sponsor a Center for Trauma. So, Tracy, why don't you give us an update, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Thank you, and thanks for being here today. I'm covering probably, the next three or four items.
Yes.
But just to orient everybody, your binders include a one-page handout that you actually received in August, which kind of provides an overview for the proposal that Resilient Utah submitted to the commission and advisory at that August meeting. This request was based on survey results that the subcommittee had. When they got up and running, I think they got responses from about 2,000 practitioners throughout the state to get a handle on what's been going on across the state about trauma-informed care and practice. And the proposal that they gave to the commission was to start some planning on establishing a center for trauma-informed care and practice, modeled on some that already exist throughout the country. Primarily, I think they were looking at trauma-informed Oregon. So for details on it, I'm probably not the best person to respond, but that one pager has information, and we just wanted to make sure that you all knew that the work was going forward. There will be a meeting with the leaders of the subcommittee. The co-chairs that are formed out of the Welfare Reform Commission are Mary Beth Vogel-Ferguson and Dr. Doug Goldsmith, and a couple of community representatives, Steve Price, who was at the last meeting, and Scott Anderson. They're having an initial meeting on the 5th with the Lieutenant Governor, and we'll then have a subsequent meeting of a broader network of stakeholders moving forward to start planning what this center will look like. And I think Max bringing up mental health in the workplace, we know that trauma and adverse childhood experiences impacts brain development, which has long-term implications for education and economic stability. So the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission is not the only entity working on the role that trauma is playing in the lives of Utahns. There's also a work group that's looking at criminal justice and trauma in the criminal justice system, and this effort is to kind of bring everybody together.
Can I ask a question, Tracy?
Sure.
We talked about this in our last IGP meeting in Florida County, and people loved it. We're thrilled with what the progress being made on it. One of the questions that somebody asked is why we're not trying to run a bill to get funding for it this legislative session. Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of policymakers who might have other ideas. I think the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative is very connected to data and research and, you know, comprehensive planning, and there was a feeling that there's more work that needs to be done to understand the breadth and scope of this center, that it would be premature to ask for funding until a well-thought-out plan was developed with the correct stakeholders. So they provided the general construct, but where it would be housed and what the actual budgetary request would be, none of that information has been pulled together.
Okay.
So there was a desire that there be some intentional planning before any type of legislative request was made.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Any question on the brief update on the Brazilian Utah? Okay.
Can I add one more thing?
Oh, please do.
If any of you want to be involved in this project, please send me your contact information. We've asked the commission members to provide us with names so that they can be part of the planning process. We just want to make sure that those who have an interest in this and expertise, which I do not claim to have, are actually at the table. Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good. Please note that that's area that I think some of the programs state I'm very less interested in. Enjoy having you, your expertise and your support there. So, thank you. Further questions for Tracy on that ongoing project? Okay, let's go to the what's occurring in the efforts for the county involvement in IGP. Tracy?
Thank you. There's a handout in your packet of an update of what's going on for the counties that are working to address intergenerational poverty. These are the counties that got funded through the state funding through the county implementation pilot grants. It's behind your Center for Resilient Utah. And the first thing that you have in that packet, just to orient everybody, is which counties are working on which goals that have been adopted by the Welfare Reform Commission. So you can see that San Pete and Utah and Weber County are working on the early childhood development goals, and then you can just go down the line for all four of the domains of child well-being in those 5- and 10-year goals. What we also included in here, and this was presented to the Economic Development and Workforce Services Interim Committee in September, so this is material that's been shared publicly. You can see each of the counties that have received funding in the first round of funding, the target population that they're working on, the goals that they stated they are working to achieve, the strategies that they're implementing, the outputs, which is like how many people are they serving in which program, and then any of the outcomes. So has anybody obtained and retained a job? Those types of outcomes that are really at the heart of what we're doing here. So I'm not going to spend any time going through all the details. Hopefully the way this is constructed will be easy to follow along, and if you have any questions about it, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. In addition to these counties, there was some additional funding that the legislature appropriated last session. I think it was slightly over $400,000, and with that money, three additional counties came on board. That's Millard, Davis, and Beaver County. They all are just trying to send in their baseline data for their plans, and the expectation is that there will be some remaining resources at the close of this first grant term, and then a decision will need to be made what to do with those remaining resources. The reason that I presented at the interim committee is that this pilot program was supposed to sunset in 2021. So I was there to provide information on the outcomes to extend the sunset 3 years. I'm not mistaken, so I think to 2024. Right now there's an interim bill. There's a committee bill that will move forward that actually extends that sunset. That does not result in any additional funding. That has to be made through the appropriations process. This will allow the ability to expend the money that was all one time until it's expended, with the hope that it'll be expended by the time the sunset for the pilot program ends. I will say, if you're interested to get a sense of where the legislature is at on the county pilot program, you might want to listen to that hearing. It's very interesting.
And that will be when?
It happened in September.
So the Wednesday meeting of the interim?
Yeah, it happened the September Economic Development and Workforce Services Interim Committee meeting. And I think it may have been 20 to 30 minutes long, if I'm not mistaken.
So we now have, Tracy, if I counted correctly, 14 counties involved?
Yes.
11 plus the 3. Mm-hmm. Questions relative to the county initiatives?
And some counties are involved, like Salt Lake County are involved, but they're not getting a county grant, so they're
right.
Continuing
Sorry.
To do their work. But didn't apply for funding.
Thank you very much. The annual report. It's time of year.
Here's the next.
So again, in your packets, I'm not going to go through using the PowerPoint just because it's not showing up very clearly. You do have in your packets the slides that I was going to use, so if you can just move to that section in the binders, and I'll put on my glasses so I can actually see.
While you're putting on your glasses, may I make an apology?
Sure.
We're delighted to have Casey with us this morning, and I didn't recognize your attendance.
It's good to be here.
You're substituting for John, I presume.
Yes, ma'am.
Any words of wisdom you'd like to impart before we proceed?
Just, it's good to be here, and, you know, if John were here, he would say something much more wise than me. So you're stuck with me for now. But I am really proud of this year's report, I would say. If you don't already know or you didn't read it, this year we took a more longitudinal look at the data, which I think is something that Ben and others and our own workforce research and analysis division here had challenged us to do, to see how the initial cohort, when we first started looking at intergenerational poverty, is doing now. And so it's really interesting. There's some good news that Tracy will tell you about. There's still a lot of work to be done. And then also we had the Utah Data Center. They were the ones that produced that report, the longitudinal look. And then Tracy kind of, in her report that she's been doing, speaks about the data and all the indicators and the progress with our 5- and 10-year plan as well. So lots of good stuff in this report. If you haven't read any of the other reports, I would encourage you to read this report because it really kind of brings it all together this year. So.
Thank you, and welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Please proceed. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem at all. And I think there's new members on the committee, so this might be the first time that you've seen the report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as I go through it. So we always start out by looking at what's been going on with child poverty. As you may or may not know, the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act is really established to measurably reduce the incidence of intergenerational poverty among Utah children. So we look at the data through the lens of the children who are experiencing intergenerational poverty. But just overall, Utah's child poverty rate is significantly lower than the national rate. This slide only goes up to 2017 because when we produced the report, the census had not released the 2018 data. But you can see that child poverty is about 20%. 1 in 5 children are living in poverty in the United States. In Utah, it's 13%. The overall poverty rate for all individuals is at 11%. And when I first started working on this in 2014, it was a little bit higher, and it just keeps going down. Largely, I would say, I don't have definitive information, but I think the economy is just kind of driving that. For those of you who aren't aware of the goal for the Intergenerational Poverty Mitigation Act, that next slide explains that really the goal, in addition to focusing on families, is to reduce the number of Utah families in the cycle of poverty, improving their quality of life, and helping them become economically stable. The next slide is the four domains of child well-being that our data is kind of analyzed in. As Casey mentioned, in this year's report, there was a research project that the agencies were involved in to do more kind of correlative and causal and statistical analysis than what the typical report is, which is largely just descriptive information. But in each of the areas of child well-being, there are 5- and 10-year goals. I mentioned when I was talking about the county information that the counties are focusing on those domains with either a focus on the 5- or 10-year goals. So if you want to read exactly what that is, since this information is so small, you can refer to that document. So who is in intergenerational poverty? In this year's report, if you've had a chance to read it, you'll know that we looked a little bit differently in defining who is in intergenerational poverty. In the past,
We included those who were receiving CHIP, the Child Health Insurance Program, and those who were receiving child care subsidies to define the population of adults and children living in intergenerational poverty. Those two programs were removed from defining the cohort. The income threshold for CHIP is much higher than the federal poverty rate, so we took that out. And we also took out the child care subsidies, because child care subsidies are considered a work support program, and by virtue of receiving them is not an indicator, we felt, from a research perspective for poverty. So with that information, going back to the slide about who's in intergenerational poverty and how we did the report, we really focused exclusively on 2018 for this analysis because of the change in the definition. It would not be accurate to look at it over time because of that change. So 28% of the adults that receive public assistance benefits from the Department of Workforce Services are experiencing intergenerational poverty. They received public assistance for at least 12 months in their adulthood and at least 12 months as children. So that's how that 28% comes about. And then those numbers underneath that are their kids. So we have 157,000 children under the age of 18 whose adult parents or guardians received public assistance for at least a year, but we don't know whether or not they received that assistance as children. But those kids, that 157,000, we would consider in jeopardy of entering the cycle of poverty. So we look at those kids. And then we have a roughly 54,000 children who we would define as experiencing intergenerational poverty. They are the kids of that 28%. So that's who's experiencing intergenerational poverty in Utah. Are there questions about that? Because that definition sometimes is confusing.
Dr. Gibbs? I haven't thought about this in a couple of years, but...
brush off the rust.
Let me say here. It was in 1989 that the data started to be collected for who's on public assistance. And so the data is always going to be a little bit right-censored, right? But that the data is improving over time because your population is aging. So how does that account for how we think about trends over time? Are these conservative estimates when you actually have more data about people? Are you adjusting for any censoring on the right?
Well, that's a great question. part of the reason that we did that longitudinal research was because of that change that was happening.
And you just see how consistent.
So, right, it seemed like difficult to track people over time when you were always bringing in another age of adults to the cohort. So that was the reasoning behind that. As you know, I'm not a technical, that language. I kind of understand what you're saying.
I mean, one way around it is...
UDRC would probably be the more...
I think in the first year, the oldest the person could be was like 40. Right?
Yeah.
And so one way you could look at trends is just always cut off at the 40-year mark and then see among that cohort, although we have more information about people that are now 45, 46, because they're born... in the 80s, 70s, and can receive public assistance, just so that you compare apples to apples.
Right.
So you could do the longitudinal for sure, but you could also get a good estimate, and you might actually find bigger changes, because really your data is getting richer over time, and so there's more people that are eligible to be IGP, and so the fact that you have declining numbers over time without correcting for that, I think the numbers would be bigger.
I think that's something... Definitely we should pursue when I think we're meeting next week, the research subcommittee. There is a research subcommittee on all of it.
Yeah, I'll bring that up.
I think that would be a great thing for that group to contemplate as we move forward.
Yeah.
This is the right time to think about that for next year's report. But great question. The next two slides kind of is highlighting that longitudinal research that Casey mentioned that we had all of the agencies perform for this year's report, and it was reviewed at the last commission meeting, so I'm just going to skip over those slides and move into each of the domains of child well-being, starting with early childhood development. The five-year goal and 10-year goal are clearly outlined here a little bit better than that house slide that we had. The first goal is to align all the systems that are involved in early childhood development to ensure that Utah has the capacity to prepare children at risk, prepare for kindergarten children at risk remaining in poverty. So to make sure that children remaining in poverty or at risk of poverty are kindergarten ready. There's a lot of movement in the early care and education field right now, also focused on that goal, as is the Governor's Education Excellence Commission and the Governor's newly formed Early Childhood Commission. And you can see the lead indicator right beneath that is the kindergarten readiness scores of children in Utah. The Utah State Board of Education started measuring that using a statewide tool that was developed a couple of years ago, and this is the first year that we have data. And as you can see, the green bar is all students in Utah based on their literacy and numeracy scores on that kindergarten assessment tool called the KEEP. And then you can see the blue bar is students experiencing intergenerational poverty. So that's kind of our benchmark. It's right now our baseline, and it shows that children experiencing intergenerational poverty entering kindergarten, 32% of them are proficient in literacy, and 49% are proficient in math. If you look at the green bar, which is all students statewide, I think there's even room to grow in that area, but 62% proficient in literacy and 73% proficient in math. So that's the indicator that we're going to be looking at over time as we continue to address early childhood development. And if you turn your page, you can look at all of the indicators that we track for early childhood development. We already talked about the KEEP scores. We also look at prenatal care and access to preventative medical care, participation in preschool, and the rates of abuse, a substantiated case of abuse and neglect. And all of that data for 2018 is included on that slide. The next slide kind of gives you some data highlights. There's an increasing number of licensed child care providers that are working to improve the quality of their programs, and that first bullet speaks to that. 30% of the children experiencing intergenerational poverty participated in a public preschool program. So there's lots of private child care, lots of private preschool programs, but in terms of the public preschool through the State Board of Education, 30% of the children are being served.
So roughly
there.
That 30% of that 54,000, is that what we're saying?
Oh, only of the 3 and 4 year olds who are preschool.
Excuse me.
So I think that's maybe 3,000 per age, 3,000 per age group. I have to find out how many it is for the 3 and 4 year olds. It's really difficult. One of the challenges in the early childhood system is that there's not one common data system, so it's really hard to get a handle on how many of them might be in a public preschool program and also a private child care setting, and we're trying to work through that through some other initiatives like the Governor's Early Childhood Commission. In 2018, 21% of children experiencing intergenerational poverty were victims of a substantiated case of abuse and neglect. And I think that that's worth noting, but you need to know what the statewide rate is in order to have any perspective. The statewide rate is 1.2%. So of the children experiencing intergenerational poverty, about 1 in 5 are victims of abuse and neglect. Any questions on early childhood development? Again, going back to mental health and the Center for Trauma-Informed Care and Practice, these issues all kind of are woven together, social determinants of health. Education, the five-year goal is around aligning systems to make sure that efforts are focused in schools disproportionately impacted by intergenerational poverty. Those include things like access to high-quality preschool, high-quality after-school programs, access to a behavioral health professional, those evidence-based programs that USBE is working so hard to put in place, making sure that the schools that have the highest rates of children, students experiencing intergenerational poverty, have those kind of foundational resources at play. And then the objective of having that done in 5 years is to make sure that children experiencing intergenerational poverty are graduating from high school at the same rate as all Utah students. And the good news is that there's been a lot of movement on that graduation rate. So I put both of those indicators on those slides. That shows the red line is the intergenerational poverty students. And when we first started tracking it, I believe in 2012, we had about the graduation rate of 50% for intergenerational poverty students. It's now up to, I think that says 78%. And the blue line is all students in Utah. So you can see, even if you can't see the numbers, you can see that the gap is closing. And I think it's not due specifically to efforts that are exclusive to the intergenerational poverty students. I think, and Dr. Nolan, you could probably speak to this better than I could, I think that there's been a lot of focus on educational outcomes in Utah, and obviously you're not separating the students. They're all being educated in the same place, so any enhancements or evidence-based strategies that are taking place in the schools is impacting everyone, and we're seeing growth in the statewide graduation rate and significant growth among this population.
So appreciating this data, and I'm wondering if there's one more data point in future ones that deal with education data, which is we have the all students, and then we have the students experiencing IGP, but do we have the non-IGP to compare it to? So for example, if you have, I'm trying to think of that, what this, because this is a subset of the other, and so I think I want to see if the rate is even greater, because here's the non-IGP students, which would then be a greater rate because the IGP students impact the average of the all students. Yeah. So it'd be nice to see all three to see if we're closing the gap even more or not. So I'm just wondering if we could have a third data point.
Yeah, and we have that data. Okay. So it was, we don't have it on this chart, but we can certainly get it. And you all provide us that information. So we're very thankful for that. It's really valuable. Great point. And we'll make sure to get it so that we have a clearer picture of that. Other questions?
I'm sorry.
No.
Wait, could you show me what, could you paint another picture about aligning systems assisting educational outcomes with schools? Is that preschool? No, that's not preschool. What does that look like?
So there's lots of initiatives underway that are managed by different entities. So a good example is, I would say, the school-based behavioral health program, which is a joint partnership between USBE and the Department of Human Services to put behavioral health specialists in schools. This recommendation or this goal is to make sure that in a resource-limited environment, which I would argue all state government is in, prioritizing that particular program in the most needed schools, so the schools that have the highest rates of intergenerational poverty. So working together to use the data to figure out where that might be and making sure that if there's not unlimited resources, using the school-based behavioral health program, make sure that there is a specialist in those schools. And then if there's additional resources, what are the other indicators where there might be a
risk? So identifying them or...
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Yep. And so there are known to be certain programs that improve outcomes for kids. Again, high-quality school readiness, preschool programs would be another one. And just following that to make sure we've got all this data, we know where the children are, we know what schools they're attending, and let's make sure that we're all working together to leverage that information to get the best outcomes.
Thank you.
And I think one part that many folks don't think of education as is fighting food insecurity. And I think that's a big issue with us that we're trying to combat this year with legislation and different things. But we have found that even in our turnaround schools, so our schools with that are, you know, receiving the most disadvantaged outcomes or opportunities, that we're having some of the administrators taking away breakfast because they're trying to have more instructional time. And we're like, are you kidding me? No, we have to have the data that shows that they're not food secure and have that. Anyway, so we have lots to be talking about when we talk about school. It's not just about the education of the child. It's about setting that system of safety and security and food security to be able to learn.
Thank you. Very helpful.
And I would just say, to the extent that you all know which schools are doing breakfast after the bell or any of those food security type programs, or addressing food insecurity, if we can populate that on the table for next year, we would love to be able to do that so that we have the correct information when we're talking about it. So the other indicators that you can see, and I will say that even though the graduation rates are really improving, we do know that the proficiency scores in language arts, third grade language arts, and eighth grade math are still really, really low. And I didn't put the slides in there. I didn't put every data point in there. But just on that table that shows the key indicators for education, you can see that only 25% are language arts proficient by third grade, and only 19% are math proficient by eighth grade. So there's lots of room for improvement there. We also know that the rates of chronic absence for students experiencing intergenerational poverty is really high. And we look at kindergarten through third grade for what that is, and that means that it's the rate of students who are missing at least 10% of the school year. And in those foundational grades, where they're building foundational knowledge, if they're chronically absent, it builds on each other, and we end up seeing much higher dropout rates for children who are chronically absent year after year.
Tracy, can I ask you something, going back to the food security thing? I know several PTAs are helping with food pantries at the secondary level. Is there any data on that? Because what they'll do is they'll open the food pantry for the weekend so that they can have some food at home over the weekend. The problem, what we're seeing, is it's not really in the elementary school. It's in the secondary school. So that would be maybe another component to maybe do, because that's somewhere where PTA can really help get more programs in the schools and the elementaries for a food pantry at the elementary level.
Why, we know why the reasons that they would affect high schoolers more than secondary schools or grade schools?
I don't know. Do you know that?
One of the reasons is the ability to transport the food or to get the food home. So we have in our secondary schools, it's more our secondary students being able to take it for their families. And so then you have the little ones at school, the ability to follow through on that process or to have family help or transporting it to and from school, where it's not as robust. So it's just the ability of the child to be able to provide that service as a young
A younger person.
So that's what we're trying to combat, is how to make that a community effort and make sure that it gets home instead of, and there's like with some of the things that are refrigerated,
yeah,
and how do we get that home and what does that look like?
Yes, please.
On the ACT score of 18 or higher, is that just with the kids who took the ACT that are in IGP, or is that everybody, including those who didn't take it?
So in Utah, all 11th grade students are required to take the ACT. So it's a really good, that's not true nationwide, but it's true in Utah. So it's actually a really good indicator for us. It kind of lines up with the third grade proficiency, eighth grade math, 18 or higher on the ACT.
And that's just been, what, the last 2 years that we've done that?
Last 2 years doing what? Which part?
Doing ACT required for June.
Yeah, it's been a little bit longer than that.
Okay.
And those results are coming out today.
Okay.
The paper with the ACT, and one of the things that's amazing is of the states that are doing it statewide, Utah is number 2, and behind Massachusetts.
Oh.
And so,
in Massachusetts, you know, it's amazing what we're doing, and with all students in there, so.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, okay. Okay, there's a couple other data updates that you can read on your own. We'll move to family economic stability. The five-year goal is to make sure that families are remaining in poverty, live in stable families, and meet their basic needs, which we are defining as food, housing, health, safety, and transportation. So there's a whole other set of indicators under that. And the 10-year goal, so the five-year goal is just to make sure they're accessing resources to meet their basic needs. The 10-year goal is obviously that these families are able to be self-reliant and meet their and actually meet their needs. In the family economic stability update, 37% of children are moving more than once in a 12-month period. So in terms of housing mobility, we're looking at that number. It's actually gone down quite a bit since we first started tracking it. It was over 42% when we first started looking at it. So in 2019, 90% of children in intergenerational poverty were enrolled in the SNAP program, which is the food stamp program. So more of the indicators are listed on the next slide. So you can see what we're looking at. 20% of the families receiving public assistance, so one in five families are experiencing intergenerational poverty. 31% of the adults had year-round employment. Adults are spending 30% of their income on housing. That's 47%. That's pretty high. Only 1% of the children are homeless. I mentioned the mobility rate, and I mentioned the SNAP rate. So those are the economic stability indicators. It's worth noting that in the longitudinal research, when we locked in that 2012 cohort and tracked them over time, the number of adults in intergenerational poverty dropped dramatically. So an adult who was in it in 2012 was not in it in 2017. The rates of children falling in that category over time dropped dramatically. Employment was up and income was higher. So for that group who we first identified, the outcomes have improved. Any questions on family economic stability?
This needs to be a moment of celebration.
Really amazing. Because here's the fact, and I think that
and we need to take time to celebrate these wins.
We do indeed. We do indeed. The focus, I think, has been very productive in terms of the last few years. That's one of the evidences of that effort. We have a lot of people to thank.
And I think it's worth noting, I think people think there hasn't been much going on because we don't have this whole laundry list of IGP initiatives that you can, like, roll out. But all the education and emphasis around data and outcomes has generated a lot of positive movement that I think is impacting several indicators that we're tracking. And I think that that's very positive for our state and our economy. In health, we have we want to ensure that all children experiencing intergenerational poverty have access to quality physical health, mental health, and dental care, regardless of where their family resides in Utah. And the 10-year goal is actually that they're utilizing those resources. And I think on a day like today, where we're seeing a really high rates of children uninsured, this is a news story today, just as an FYI, I always think about our data with intergenerational poverty where we have lots. The rate of coverage through the public health insurance programs is incredibly high for the kids living in intergenerational poverty, as it is for the adults living in intergenerational poverty. The challenge is, if you look at the next set of indicators, is that these families and kids are not accessing health care. They're not accessing preventive health care at the level that we would want them to get their medical needs met. And DOH, the Department of Health, which is a partner to this project, looks at their health provider shortage areas, and there are lots in our state. So it's one thing to, like, make sure that there's enough food. It's another thing to make sure people are consuming it. It's one thing to make sure people are insured. It's another thing to make sure that they're actually getting the care that they need. And although we track rates of coverage, I think the data is revealing to us that that's not the primary challenge for this population. It's accessing the medical care that they need. And, you know, if you have to drive 2 hours to see a behavioral health specialist in one of our rural communities, it's going to be really challenging to get that need met. And that was something that the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute found in their mental health analysis. So you can see the indicator around preventive medical care by age for the intergenerational poverty population. That's based on Medicaid usage and diagnosis codes. And then you can see 45% of those with a behavioral health need on this last page actually receive care. So the orange is the entire bar is the number of individuals who needed care. The orange is the individuals who actually got the care, and the red is the remaining population that did not get the care that they were diagnosed to have needed. So that's the summary, and if I were to encapsulate it into a comprehensive kind of conclusion, I think there's a lot of progress being made. And I think that that's always a very positive thing that you all should be aware of. And there are still challenges that remain for this population. The data allows us to kind of fine-tune what those challenges are. The county efforts are really generating their priorities, focusing on their strengths and resources in their communities to address this issue. It's just something that Utah should be very proud of, that its leadership has taken on and continues to work on it.
Questions? Given the review of the annual report, it's a nice segue in a discussion. Brief discussion relative to what the ongoing priorities are, Tracy, and the three priorities that we've identified for discussion.
So just a high-level overview of what we're kind of presenting to all of you, three priorities for 2019. I already talked about Center for Trauma-Informed Care Practice. That's absolutely a priority that will move forward through the planning process and see where that takes us to address some of these needs. The next is, I'll start at the top, Classroom on Wheels. This is a joint project that's being discussed between the Department of Workforce Services and the Department of Heritage and Arts. They have STEM buses. Science, technology, engineering, and math, buses that they are contemplating repurposing to focus on early childhood. So one of the discussion points is to repurpose the STEM bus so it's early childhood focused and going into rural communities where there is limited access to early educational opportunities and enrichment opportunities. This is just in the very initial phase of discussion. In addition to kind of repurposing the bus so that it's STEM focused and early childhood emphasis, there's an increasing need for parents to complete developmental screenings for their children. So if they're on the bus, there's opportunity. You've got a captive audience to maybe do some more education and outreach on things like developmental screenings. And we will be talking with the Department of Health, who does vision and hearing screenings, and possibly thinking about making sure that those two things are happening at the same time. While the parents are there with their young kids, they can have these other needs met at the same time. So this is, again, in the very, very early stages. I think that there's interest in thinking about which communities to identify as a pilot and see if we can generate some interest in these communities for the parents to get on the bus with their kiddos and engage in some activities. So that is
an interesting concept. Is there some discussion relative around that out-of-the-box kind of thinking?
Well, I think BTA can really help with that because we have rural parents and rural ETAs
when we set up a PTA last year in Antibone, Utah. The one.
Antibone?
Uh-huh. One school.
Okay, you're missing my ability. Is that Wayne Cabin?
Garfield, I believe. You see that, yeah. But it was very awesome to go in there. They have one principal, and I think they had 13 kids. But something like that, I think that little community would eat that up.
Well, that's great. Yeah. I think that any information on targeting communities, I think that there's a lot of factors to consider. The rates of intergenerational poverty. Are there other child care providers, other enrichment opportunities for those families? Does the school system have a high-quality preschool program? At least on the outset when we test this, we're really thinking about a community that lacks resources in any form for early childhood. So we'll make sure that as we move forward with this priority that we're focusing on you folks and bringing you into the conversation.
This isn't related to the classroom or anything else, but I'm just reminded, maybe I should know this. The state invests a lot of money in the Upstart program and designs that in a way that makes computers and internet access available, I think, to low-income families. Do we know to what extent they are targeting and able to get those resources to, for example, IGP households?
That's a really interesting question.
It's something we actually, our IGP task force is starting with our little group that we're going to promote the Upstart program and trying to get people lots. We're going to be meeting with them soon, and I'm happy to share with you whatever.
So I bring it, it's an interesting question because I've had to go to Education Interim with USBE and Upstart to talk about this issue. Due to privacy reasons, we are not providing a list to Upstart of families living in intergenerational poverty. But we are mailing to the families on behalf of the Upstart program at the request of the legislature, and we do that once a year. They are then asking for case numbers of families so that we can then go back to. And then we also mail not just to intergenerational poverty, but to TANF-eligible families. We then match to see what the rates are. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but we can get them to you. It's not a huge uptake, which is not surprising, because there just isn't a huge uptake. What I have said, and said publicly, again, focusing on the data-driven focus that this effort has, we don't know from Upstart whether or not the families from DWS, either an IGP or receiving public assistance, are successfully completing the Upstart program. And we've been talking to Upstart about getting that information and figuring out the graduation rates. And I think in the last year with Cohort 10 was the first year they were even tracking graduation rates. So to me, it's still an open question. It's not, there's nothing bad about supplementing your child's education at home. I think from a data perspective, it's still an open question about whether or not we know Upstart is getting tremendous outcomes. We just don't know if those outcomes are impacting this particular population. And we're trying to get an answer to that question so that if you do push Upstart in your communities, you know that you're pushing something that's going to be getting the outcomes that they have been shown to get for the general population.
So do they need to, if we find out, because we're just targeting all of them in our Redwood Elementary area, do we need to have some verification that then they are receiving public assistance in order for them?
Upstart takes care of that.
They know all of that.
Upstart takes care of that in their intake.
Okay.
So they do a questionnaire.
An annual income question. And so that you just put in the annual income question so it doesn't ask more invasive questions.
They do ask if they have a case number with DWS. That was the way that we were able to figure out if they were intergenerational poverty. And with Ed in the room, it's reminding me that last year the legislation was changed so that it doesn't necessarily just have to be in the home, a private child care provider, either a licensed family provider or a licensed center provider can put the Upstart system in their program. And I think they're working out some glitches on how to make that happen effectively. So if it's in a high poverty community and the private child care provider wants to put the system in each, primarily literacy, if I'm not mistaken, they can use the Upstart terminal in their overall program.
Can I add a little bit of information?
Yes, please.
Where we are. So with the Utah private child, we've got several private providers, licensed centers that are collaborating and working through that, building the programming and everything. What we found most effective, rather than us taking on the full responsibility of tracking everything, with really getting the families initiated, then they're responsible, and then we supplement that program within our centers. That's currently the way we've gotten started. So, and that's still, what, you know, we meet again, I think it's next week or so, to fully get some of the next steps built in. But right now, we see that there should be quite a few private centers able to participate and collaborate with the parents, help collect that information and get people to children actually enrolled in the program, which is a big effort from our side to catch all those kids and actually bring them in where they would probably not have participated before.
They then have to use the curriculum to fidelity when they get home from the program. So it's still a heavy, I would say, a heavy lift if you're at work all day and then you're coming home. And so hopefully they'll get the child care providers and Upstart will get to a point that they actually are utilizing the curriculum in the program, which was the intent of the legislation. So a good question. Moving on to the other priority, the last priority, recognizing that movement in addressing intergenerational poverty is not exclusively within the responsibility of state government. We now have business at the table, which is fantastic. We continue to forge ahead with identifying counties that can really move the needle on improving outcomes for families living in those counties. So our team is starting to look at data again, rates of intergenerational poverty currently existing, economic indicators, to identify three additional counties to come to the table and hopefully provide them with their county level data. See if they're interested, like we did in 2016, in addressing the issue, and we will support them in that effort. So our 14 counties will become 17 counties, but we're just in the initial phases of that. That project of onboarding a county and supporting them is really, I would say, a 17 to 18 month project. So just even though it's a priority, we're contemplating it as a priority. It's something that takes a significant amount of support and work on an ongoing basis and moving forward. So those are the three priorities at the moment.
Anyone who would like to ask questions about the priorities or suggest others that might be appropriate? Yes, Professor?
I'm curious about the status of the existing counties and their commissions. I'm sure some are thriving, some are tripping along. Are there goals in place or, I don't know, ways to follow up with these counties to see how they're progressing?
So the counties that are getting funded are required to report to us quarterly in their fourth quarterly reports, I think. I was just talking to TJ, who's overseeing all the counties. They think they're due today or by the end of this week. The preliminary outcomes or the outcomes we have thus far are included on that spreadsheet. It's really detailed, so if you have any questions about it, just let me know. So, yes, you're correct. Some are limping along. Some have decided that they're kind of done. And we're continuing to give support to those programs who may not have gotten funded but still want to be involved. some of the counties are saying, you know, Sevier County is a great example. They're really heavily involved. They're not getting any money. They're trying to address the issue with the resources that they already have. So everybody's approaching it a little bit differently. But yeah, they are accountable to us. The law required that of them, and we keep them on a pretty tight timeline to report to us both how many families and children they're serving with their programs and whether or not they're getting any outcomes. So.
Further questions or additions to the priorities? Well, in the absence of hearing the bill, we will assume that they meet with our unanimous approval to go forward in the next calendar year, 2020, which will be upon us almost next week.
Feels like with the weather, for sure.
Okay. Entertain any public comment that might be made? Appreciate your being in attendance, but if there's any comment you'd like to make, we would enjoy them now. Not seeing any, we would entertain a motion for adjournment. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Give me a second. We'll call for the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I never have seen a motion to thank you for your attendance, and thank you for what you do to bless the lives of particularly the children. I was heartbroken when I saw a statistic about some of the things that happened to children. Get the IGP children. Thank you all. Have a great holiday season. I draw your attention as you walk out the door to the schedule for 2020. There are four planned meetings at the moment. The first being in the St. George in January. Thank you all.
Can
yes,
I
please.
I have to be excused in that one because that's the date of our board meeting, so I won't be attending that one. Thank you.
If there's a local person down there who would like to have...
She'll be up here for our meeting.
Oh, I give up. Okay. I give up. Thank you.
It's a joint meeting. Please leave your binders. Yeah. If you want to take your materials to today's meeting, feel free to do that, but leave your binders.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
That's good. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.